Well, welcome to His Holy Church X Space. You can follow us at His Holy Church on X. You can also request topics. You can follow us at preparingyou.com and join the network and actually do some of the things that we're talking about and that the gospel talked about and that a lot of people don't want to do because they want a nice, comfortable religion. And then they're going to solve all their problems by electing a particular political party. And then they're going to go out and get rid of all the corruption and keep them safe and socially secure. If you think that's going to work, you haven't studied much history. So anyway, I see more people showing up already. And of course, you can eventually ask a question. We want to stay on topic. And today's topic is police powers. And we've done a show on police powers already. And in that process of those studying the police powers, we realized, or we should have realized, that the police powers that we see in modern governments today are originally the power of the people. That's where it came from, because God created people, and then people started creating governments. So originally, whatever power people gave to their government was from them originally. And so how would they give that power to government? Well, obviously, one way is by consent. And the whole story of Cain and Abel, Cain had one system and Abel had another system. And we've explained that in a lot of other places. And somehow when we look at the metaphors in the Bible, they talk about Abel's altar and Cain's altar and what Cain and how Cain got stuff to put on his altar and how Abel got stuff to put on his altar. And of course, Abraham built altars and he built altars so much and taught other people how to build altars that when a five-king army came through and was conquering and pillaging and taking captives and what have you, Abraham was able to muster an army overnight. And he did so not only with the people that followed Abraham directly, but also the people who he had taught how to build altars. So something about those altars encourage these people to drop everything they were doing and go off and fight this army with Abraham and succeed at defeating it. And we have, you know, we have articles up at Preparing You on Abraham. And one of the pictures we have there on his page is a picture sketched out by a famous artist. We use a lot of his stuff because they're royalty free. And also they're a lot of biblical stories. Julius, I think, is his name. But there Abraham was with all kinds of men with swords and spears and shields, evidently enforcing the law. That somebody came and they drove off the king of Sodom, who was Bera, and he fled out into the tar pits. And they just went through the city and pillaged whatever they wanted. And they ended up taking Lot and probably a lot of other people and animals and gold and silver, whatever they could haul away. And Abraham went and stopped them in a police action. He went out there with a bunch of other guys and stopped them. And there was evidently a lot of spoils now, because he defeated that army. And when King Bera came out, he told Abraham, you can keep the stuff, you know, all the things that you were able to get from this army that you defeated, the spoils of that battle, but just give me the people. And we've explained that the people were human resources. There were two forms of government floating around at that particular time in history. And one of those forms of government made the people human resources. But that didn't mean they didn't enter into those systems by consent. There might have been people that were captured and enslaved. Obviously, Lot had been captured and he was being taken off. Exactly under what classification, we don't really know. But he was saved by Abraham. And another guy shows up, a guy named Melchizedek. And he shows up, and in the picture they show him with all kinds of armed men and equipment. But he's bringing food supplies to the army that Abraham put together. And how is he supported? Where did he get his funds to put together his army? Well, evidently, Abraham had tithed to him and given him gifts of some sort. And yet, there Abraham was, winning the day in a police action. So anyway, let's get back on the topic directly of police on an everyday basis. And of course, like I said, we were establishing that, you know, you could have your city police that where the police chief was appointed by the mayor, or you could have your state police where the head of the state police is appointed by the governor, or you could have other police agencies that are elected by the people, like the sheriff. The sheriff wasn't always elected by the people. Early on, if you go way back in Anglo-Saxon time, we had this one topic that appeared that they talked about a particular type of mutual pledge society or mutual pledge system, which was like the Anglo-Saxons. And that could be considered a, you know, and this came up in the last show, a covenant society. And that's kind of what a mutual pledge society is. I don't like the use of the word pledge. I would prefer something like covenant. But of course, I wrote the book, Contracts, Covenants, and Constitutions, that shows you that this idea of making a social contract or covenant where you empower government, that's basically what the Constitution did. It empowered government. It took some of the power that was in the hands of the individual states and it put it in the federal government. And it outlined what powers were delegated to them. And they said any powers not delegated to them remained with the states or with the people. Now the question might occur, did the people delegate any power since that document was created? Because there is a contract clause where by contract you could delegate more power to government. And there are many ways to do that by direct, you know, specific, handwritten, black and white contract, but also contract by deed, where either you're committing a crime or you're making an agreement. And of course, we could go into that, but we'll save that for a program on constitutions, etc. But the reality is a great deal of power was being put into the hands of something we call government. We were creating it. And to some degree, it's a mutual pledge system, but a mutual pledge system is more like an honor system. You don't have any direct enforcement. But ancient Israel, like I said, the Anglo-Saxon England communities were pledge systems. They were supported usually not by taxes early on. If you go back in the history, it was also supported like Melchizedek, who was that king of Salem, was supported by tithings, free will offerings. And of course, that sounds like, how could you support a government like that? Well, the army was the militia. You had a right to bear arms, and we mentioned this also, that right to bear arms originally meant the obligation to bear arms. If you were very poor, you might not have anything but a club. If you were a really poor farmer, you might have a pitchfork. You might have a staff, and you would use that. That's kind of like a long club. But you also might have axes, and you might be able to afford a sword or a short sword or a dagger. Those things were around for a long time. And you might have those things too. But then you have to organize yourselves to be a militia, because you have to have a well-organized militia. That's what well-regulated means. And you could do that. And that would be a part of the police force. I could show you old stories, written novels, written back in the 1700s and 1800s about men, you know, somebody was robbed. And all the people turned out to try to find the robber. And it was like years, 10, 15 years before they found out who robbed the guy. And they found the money. But they all knew about it. And they restored the money to the guy who had been robbed. And what had happened is a guy had peered through a window and saw that the guy had where he hid his money. And when he was gone, he broke in and stole the money. But he did it in the darkness of night, and he ended up falling off a cliff and drowned in a water. And eventually, when they drained the water, they found him and all the gold, and they restored it to the original guy. All the people were the police. There was no constable that was doing this. It was the people and what we call the hue and cry. And in a pledge society, though, you're going to have maybe some people that you rely on more than other people, and you'll figure that out. You might say, well, you're going to be our tithing man. Yeah, we're going to check with you when we need to, you know, find a criminal or find a lost child or put out a fire. Because the responsibility of the community was in the hands of the community. They had no king. And of course, there's a whole, we're coming up on that in our study of Leviticus, where they say there was no king in Israel. And the answer really was because every man was king. And he did what was right in his own eyes. And that works out pretty good when men's conscience is unseared. When men's conscience are perceptive as to what is good and evil. And so every man, that's his obligation. We just did this in Leviticus 5, where one of the first things it says is that if you have any information about something that was done wrong, somebody stole something, somebody lied about something, somebody bore false witness, somebody, you know, injured somebody, and you have any information, you have to bring it forward. You can't close your shades. You can't say, I don't want to get involved. If you're going to be a government of the people, for the people, and by the people, you have to get involved. But you also have to have a clear conscience, so that you have a clear perception of what is. And that's why we're talking about police powers, because there's a lot of confusion out there. How much power does a policeman have, and where did he get it? And am I disobeying God when I disobey a policeman? Well, you might be. And then what do we do when a policeman does something that is outside of his authority? Well, how do you know what's inside of his authority? Have you looked up the rules? Do you know how he was empowered to begin with? Is he a sheriff? Is he a city police? Do you understand jurisdiction? And then we have to get into courts. What kind of courts would you have? Well, what kind of courts did they have in these pledge societies like ancient Israel and the Anglo-Saxons? Well, they say they had common law courts in ancient Anglo-Saxon. Part of the problem when people study these things like common law courts and common law itself is you have to say, okay, you say this was the common law. What time frame are we talking about? You know, is this constitutional? Things that were not constitutional in 1820 became constitutional by 1870. Because the Constitution changed and the people's relationship to the Constitution changed. So you can't just read the old document and say, well, now I understand the Constitution. Of course, in reading it, you would have to look at the meaning of the words at the time. Yeah, you know, I just put together a little brief article. It was on, you know, the Talmud and the Medrash, which is writings about the Talmud and all these kinds of things. Well, it's extremely biased writings. And they tell you that they make these writings to bridge ancient text of the Bible, the Torah, to modern thinking. Of course, they started this like in 100 CE, all the way up into 1000 CE. But they're not really bridging it. They're altering it. They're changing it. They're interpreting the ancient text according to what they want it to mean. And of course, people could say the same thing about what we're doing as we're going through Leviticus. But the reality is we've done enough work now that there's enough cross-references where we can see a pattern developing in the Old Testament with Abraham and Isaac and these two systems of government, one that makes you a human resource and the other one that sets the captive free and returns every man to his family and every man to his possession. And what brings you into bondage, there's a number of things, obviously consent, but covetous practices do it. But in ancient Israel, they had courts. You had congregation of 10, you know, which was a free assembly. They call it a free assembly. It's not a corporation. But they get together and decide fact and law. And they determine, and then they publish that to everybody, maybe just but with their speaking. But they give outward signs that we've made an agreement that this is how we've concluded this. And they had a system of appeals courts. You would know that if you went to most of your rabbis, most of your preachers. Ask them about the appeals courts in the Bible. They won't be able to tell you. They know nothing about that. Because in today's society, people have turned the law over to the government. The original king in Israel, when they first decided to have a king, and this question came up last time, and they asked me, what are the five things that it tells you in the Bible to put in a constitution if you decide to have a king? Well, of course, the word we see in the Bible is Deuteronomy 17:14. You know, when thou art coming to the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, and shalt possess it, and shall dwell therein, and shall say, I will set a king over me, like all the other nations that are about me. So how did they do that? Well, they asked Samuel to pick a king. They weren't even going to elect him. They were just going to pick him. But, you know, we have these big demonstrations, no king. They don't want to have any king. But the reality is, whether you're going to elect a governor, you know, any kind of chief executive officer, you're going to elect a sheriff. How much power does this sheriff have? You know, he's going to go out and enforce laws. Who made those laws? The legislature. So if you're going to elect a legislature, you're going to elect a king. You just divide the power between the king and the legislature. So you have a Senate and you have a Congress. In Rome, they had a Senate. You've divided the power into three branches of government. And, you know, then you have a judiciary. And you say that's over at this branch. Now, these have all merged quite a bit over the years. And we could go through that whole history. But the program would become very long. And we want to stick on the topic of this police power. So as soon as you are electing a king, a governor, a president, a prime minister, a mayor, you are giving them some power. And like I said, and we have articles on this, the Romans classified these powers into two different branches. One was the Imperium and the other is the Potestas. And both the Imperium and the Potestas originally rested with the heads of every family. But when they start turning some of that power over to a government, they don't have it anymore. If they turn it over to a government and allow that government to create debt, they can't even get it back without paying off the debt. And the fact is that God operates by contracts, covenants, and constitutions. If you say yes, you have to make your yes, yes, and your no's, no. So yeah, does the government of the United States have police powers? Yes. Did you used to have those police powers? Well, somewhere back in your ancestry, you did. Shortly after the American Revolution, you probably had a great deal of those powers in the hands of the individual American. But you don't anymore. You turn them. Can you get them back? Well, yes, but the means and method that you use to get them back will determine the nature of those powers that you get. You know, there's revolutions down in South America, used to be all the time. And usually the dictator they got was worse than the dictator they had before. And that's often the case. So if you're going to have a revolution, make sure you have the right to have that revolution. And that was one of the unique things about the American government, is that they had a unique right to have the American Revolution. We've covered that in great detail because of the colonial charters, because the king was usurping authorities. We talked about it last week, even. In the actual parliament in England, men argued that the king didn't have the power to impose certain taxes in America that he can impose anywhere else in the kingdom, even in bishoprics, which are supposedly under the authority of the church. But of course, by that time, there was already the Church of England. Another whole strange topic. Most people are unaware of exactly what all that meant, but and how far that really went and how that's going to affect their future. But what are those five things? Let's go over those real quick. And they're right there, like I say, in Deuteronomy 17, 14. And in 17, 15, it says, "Thou shalt in any wise set a king over thee," any kind of ruler, anybody with executive power, "whom the Lord thy God shall choose." So who's choosing, you or God? And then how does God choose it? Well, you could do it with a democracy, but you better have very wise voters and very limited supply of voters and not just let anybody vote. Because the people who vote have to be choosing based on the wisdom of God. And most people don't have that anymore because they've strayed in all these other ways. But Israel at that time hadn't made quite all that strain. They had rejected God, and he tells us that in 1 Samuel 8. You can read that too. But he says, "Shall choose one from amongst thy brethren, shalt thou set a king over thee. Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee, which is not thy brother." Okay, what makes somebody your brother? Bloodline or obedience to the father? Because if you don't obey the father, then you're not really the son. You could maybe become a prodigal son and come back, but you're out. You're not an inheritor. What's a stranger? Stranger is he's got to be a part of what you're doing. He can't be a part of something else. He can't have loyalty to something else other than what you're doing. And so that would have to be in there. But then what does that mean and how do you interpret that? But we'll just move on to some of these other things. So, you know, I can guarantee you that a lot of the presidents and prime ministers that are elected in countries all around the world are not your brother. I can just guarantee you that from mere observation. So what is verse 16 say? But he shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt, to the end that he should multiply horses. For as much as the Lord hath said unto you, he shall henceforth return no more that way. So there's two things here mentioned, not return to Egypt and not multiply horses unto himself. And then they repeat that, that if you return to Egypt, to the end that he should multiply horses. What's he talking about? Well, in Egypt, 20% of your labor belonged to the government. He got your bricks, he got, you know, the things that you make, the grains that you grew, he got your sheep, he got your cattle. So he had a constant influx of funds, only 20%, but he had these funds. He can now hire soldiers, he can hire cavalrymen, he can hire charioteers, and they move with horses. That's, horses were a symbol of that power of the army to move. And so he multiplied horses, and then he returned you to the bondage of Egypt, or did something that might return you to the bondage of Egypt, cause you to go back into the bondage of Egypt. He didn't just put you there. He caused you to consent to the bondage of Egypt. Then he got more and more supplies. And of course, if Joseph didn't do your contract, he might get more than 20%, because it does prophesy that it will be worse for you in the latter days than it was at the time of Egypt. So you're probably going to have to pay more than 20% of your labor every year to the government. And he can hire more and more soldiers and put them on more and more horses, and he can even invent mechanical horses so he can put them in Jeeps and police cars and Humvees and all those things. But he can't do, it's written in there, he cannot do anything that might cause you to return to the bondage of Egypt. But that was done. FDR did it. FDR said that if, you know, that I will take care of you in this time of depression, in this time of famine, I will give you bread. Isn't that what the Pharaoh said? I will give you bread to eat, you know, benefits from my larder, from my granaries, but you have to pledge a portion of your labor. Well, you did that with the Social Security Act, and they already had the instrumentality to collect that, because they had legalized income tax for corporations and fiduciaries of corporations with the 16th Amendment. So you voluntarily went down and got numbered to obtain benefits. Now, did he make you do that? Well, he made it easy for you to do that, so we would have to look very closely at that word cost. But he didn't make anybody do that. It was a voluntary act. It actually still is a voluntary act, but you might not survive unless you do that, because you need that number to function in his world, in his constitutional order and system of government. So the fact is that FDR was able to do this because people were so dependent already upon the government, and their churches were actually hardly even functioning like the early churches. They weren't feeding the masses. A lot of the people weren't even going to church. But the early Christians, they were rightly dividing the bread from house to house day one. But by the time of the American Depression, they didn't say, well, don't go to the government. We'll help you out. We'll take care of your needy. You know, we'll feed you. They didn't say that. As a matter of fact, there was a church that complained and said that, no, we don't want to do this Social Security Act. And they opposed it for a little while. And then, you know, I've told this story. I mean, we've written about it. You can look it up. He met with Eleanor Roosevelt. And Eleanor Roosevelt made a deal with him. And I guess it probably was with the church that he was representing. And then they withdrew their objection. And I go into a lot of details on that, but it kind of gets us off the police powers. But we want to stay on these five things that should have been in your Constitution, where the police power does not move from the individual family to the corporate government. Because the United States government is a corporate government. It was at the very beginning of the Constitution, because you read it, it reads as a corporate charter. It was a corporation then. Now, possibly, and we have audios on that, or actually have videos on that, there were changes in the nature and relationship of that corporation with other people. But fundamentally, it didn't change. It's you changing your relationship with government and your dependence upon it. And of course, the Bible writes over and over again not to eat at the table of rulers, because they serve deceitful meats. Their dainties will bring you into bondage, turn you into human resources. It tells you that in the New Testament. It tells you that in the Old Testament over and over again. But you're probably, many of you go to churches that don't point that out, because they're daughters of the harlot, who said that it's okay to covet your neighbor's goods through these kings, who are going to force the contributions of the people, despite the fact that Samuel told Saul, when he forced a sacrifice, he says, you've done a foolish thing. You shouldn't have done this. Your kingdom's not going to stand. And the reality is, all the governments of the world depend upon forced contributions to support their government, because they're all not fashioned like Melchizedek, not like Christ, who was considered the Melchizedek of the New Testament. That's what it tells us in Hebrews. He's a priest and king according to the order of Melchizedek, according to the way of Melchizedek. But people don't go the way of Christ anymore. So they have created kings, governors, mayors, and they are appointing men from the top down, just like Nimrod. You can elect your sheriff, but your sheriff has to go to their school and learn how to be a sheriff. And the laws that he's enforcing are the laws of the United States, or the laws of the individual states, or the laws of your county. He can also enforce county laws. But how did the government get such power to create so many laws regulating the lives of the people? Well, because the people became human resources when they decided that they wanted benefits at taxpayers' expense. That if you decided to covet your neighbor's goods through the men who exercise authority, the men you elected, you chose to elect, then you've become human resources. The Bible says, it translates the word merchandise. You belong to the state. You're a surety for debt. Your children are surety for debt. Let me finish up this last item here, which is some might say fourth and fifth item. It's in verse 17. Neither shalt thou multiply wives to himself, and his heart turn not away, neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. Well, of course, that's all done. multiply wives, what does that mean? Well, we know Solomon had all these wives. Why did he have all these wives? Because he was making treaties with other governments. And every time he made a treaty with this king or this ruler of a city-state, he would get one of their daughters as a wife. It was a way of consummating their contractual relationship. And it consolidated his power. And how he was consolidating his power so much, and I brought it up in our study of Exodus. It was brought up in the Jordan Peterson's expose on Exodus. It was brought up by one of the scholars, and we were following that along as we were going through Exodus to kind of bounce off of the, and I pointed out a number of their errors, error by Ben Shapiro, an error by Prager, Dennis Prager, and their interpretation. But one guy there, I don't remember what his name is right offhand, but I did mention it in our recordings on Exodus, brought up the fact that King Solomon was returning Israel to the bondage of Egypt. It was creating what they call a corvée system of statutory labor. That's where a portion of your labor belongs to the government. And he was creating that, which was, of course, why, you know, he was breaking every rule in the book. But most of the people who study Solomon don't know exactly what rules he's breaking because they've been looking at these different interpretations of the Bible that don't really tell you what Israel was doing. Because Israel had no forced taxation, no mandatory draft. They almost instituted that, but David repented of it. They had no central treasury. They eventually, when they did build a temple, that became a central treasury. But David put off building the temple. And of course, when they came out of captivity, they did the same thing again. And the men who knew what the Bible really meant, they wept when they saw people building it according to the ways that was already an apostasy, building a central temple. Now you have Christians all over the world and all over America hoping that they rebuild the stone temple. We should weep when they say that, because they can actually rebuild Israel according to the ways of Moses right now if they had that clear conscience and understanding of the text. So if your government has the power to make treaties for you with other governments, it has the power to accumulate wives. Because that marriage, that's that agreement. That's that covenant. He's making covenants with other governments. And that should be forbidden, that he couldn't do that. And we can show you over and over again that was the case in Israel. When they were starting to go the wrong way is when they started making covenants with people like Caesar. Aristobulus made a covenant with Caesar to guarantee his throne, but eventually it wasn't Caesar at the time, it was Pompey, but it was Rome. But he said no. Pompey eventually realized what Aristobulus was up to and withdrew his support of Aristobulus and gave it to Hyrcanus. But Hyrcanus had other problems. But the fact is that Jesus could come to the point where Pontius Pilate, as a chief financial officer and procurator of Rome, actually at that particular time, another long story, wants to try him and see if he's guilty of some form of sedition or claiming to be king when he didn't have the right to claim to be king. And what Jesus says is that my kingdom's not of your world. I don't have any treaties with you. I've made no agreement to give you that power. The Pharisees have, but the Pharisees don't have the power to do that. The Pharisees were taking shiploads of grain and bread from Rome on a regular basis, had laws saying that they could bring the dainties of Rome. And those dainties were brought in because Rome was killing people and selling children into slavery. So anyway, you can't have this idea in Deuteronomy 17 of making treaties or accumulating the gold and silver. And when they accumulated the gold in the golden calf, they were creating a reserve fund, a Fort Knox, a bank. And Moses said, no, the gold was to be in your personal purses. The treasury of the kingdom of God, of a free government, is in the hands of everybody. And we can go into a long discussion of how that made America strong. I just saw a video, I made a mark of it, where a guy was being interviewed by Elon Gelick, thought leaders. I can never pronounce his name quite right, but anyway. And he said that we need to go back to the gold standard where you have gold in your pockets. At least go back to the gold standard where the money is backed by gold. And he doesn't know how we can get there. Well, I know how you can get there. Is that you have to repent and start seeking the kingdom of God and his righteousness, which means taking back your responsibilities. Now, the governments of the world are the unrighteous mammon. They force the contribution. They're the city of Cain, and they often become cities of blood. You know, if you go into the Marxist realm, you know, like China did or the Soviet Union did, millions upon millions of people are going to die. And of course, there's millions of people in America that want to go that way. And they have no idea that they are signing their own death warrant. But you don't have to go that way. You can turn around and go the other way. Start taking back your responsibilities. And how we do that, that would be a good point of discussion. But you have to have clear thinking. You have to know their laws. You have to know the limitations of their laws. You can't imagine it. You have to actually know where their limitations are. And you're not the court. They have a court. They're the unrighteous mammon. Yeah, got it. They're the city of Cain. Yeah, got it. But you all live in the city of Cain. And so therefore you have to give to Caesar what is Caesar. You have to give the authority that Caesar has given his police force to his police force. But I tell you, if you start really repenting and going back the way Christ said from the beginning, you will have a power in their courtroom and in the presence of their officers that these people screaming on the side of the road and blowing whistles and making all kinds of claims and disrupting their duties and obstructing and impeding do not have. And one of the key things they do not have is the protection of the Holy Spirit, because they are rebels. You don't want to be a rebel. You want to be righteous. Seek the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and you will be protected to some degree. I can't guarantee. I have to approach things from the point of view of Gideon. They wanted to make Gideon a king, and he said, no, I and my family will not rule over you. But he also said, though he may slay me, I shall serve him. He was going to follow a particular way, a particular pattern. Americans have not been following that way and pattern for years and years, Europe even longer. And they are facing population collapse. They have brought an army of voters into their country that is going to, they've been cheating on voting for years and years. You could say, well, that makes them an unlawful government. Well, it does, but it doesn't make you lawful. You see, it's not the fact that there are a lot of, corruption out there. We've got Article 2, Section 22. You just look that up at ours, and we show you how the government of Oregon was completely unlawful where you, if you had the proper Secretary of State in place, but you only had one that was appointed, you could have removed 80% of the people holding public office, including mayors. And they couldn't even run again. You could have removed them that day. You could have sent the state troopers in and had them arrested right in their office and bar them from their office. Perk walk them right out of their office. That was in the law. And it was a matter of public record who you could do that to. But they didn't have the courage. They didn't have the morality. They didn't have the clearness of thought to do it. And so that government ended up changing the law. Now, it was doing it unlawfully because everybody presenting these laws to be changed didn't hold their law, their office legally. But does that mean we get to insurrect? We haven't straightened out our house. We're not doing what Christ said. We're not going to, you, if you're going to face the armies of the world, the pharaohs of the world, the federal pharaohs of the world, you better have your house in order. That's why God hardened the heart of the pharaoh, who would not let them go. They weren't ready to go. They had no system of social welfare that was operating according to the order of Melchizedek in place. They had no free assemblies where they knew each other in the tens, hundreds, and thousands. Christ required that you do that. The early church did that. You don't do it. You're a Baptist or a Methodist or a Presbyterian or a Catholic or a Jehovah Witness or nothing. You're not ready for freedom. But we could go into a lot of the other stuff that I have other stuff on. I could point out some of the things that we didn't go through in the last show, how the London Metropolitan Police were organized according to the what they call the Pelian principles, supposedly to protect and serve, and people like that. And it sounds very good. But I've seen the words protect and serve on the side of the police cars turn into a force in your community. and to tell you the truth, I think we have remarkably good police all across this nation with some really remarkably good souls in there. Many of them would actually follow the way of Christ if somebody would actually teach it to them, just like the Roman centurion did. And so I don't want to ever demonize the idea of police. I'm really speaking about the criticism of the people who have chosen to covet their neighbor's goods through the men who exercise authority one over the other. And as we go through Leviticus, we got through Leviticus 5. I haven't got through the audios of Leviticus 5 yet, but we'll eventually put them up. But I've already been expanding the notes on that so you start to understand what this thing, atonement, is all about, why there's a priest. Jesus was considered the king and priest according to the order of Melchizedek. Each family, the head of each family should be king and priest in his family. But then how does he come together in the tens, hundreds, and thousands so that he can be free with the strength of Abraham, with the strength eventually Jacob had? And that will take revelation on the part of each individual. So the Pelian principle was basically, you know, it's phenomenal if you look at the British police force. Of course, they had the sheriff, the Guerrers, way back in ancient times. And then when William the Conqueror came, he enlisted the Sheriff Reeves, and they became appointed from the top down instead of from the bottom up. But only in certain sections of England, because William the Conqueror didn't occupy all of England. Only those people who fought with Harold against him. But over the next 300 years, they consolidated this. And there's a whole history of that. But he also set up his own courts. And so therefore he had to have his law enforcement officers bring you into his courts. The other courts still existed. And you could actually write in your contract that, you know, they're trying to do this with Sharia law, where they have a marriage contract and they say, this marriage contract will be decided according to Sharia law. And there is a certain right to do that within religion. But I guarantee you that the Muslims will assert beyond their right to do that, because they also are preaching in their mosques the eventual violent overthrow of the United States government. We're not preaching that. We understand that the government is there and it has its place. We're preaching, we're going according to the plan of Jesus, who, right in the middle of the Roman Empire, created tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people that did not eat the free bread of Rome, that operated right in the different city-states all over the Roman Empire. People were so jealous of their success that they were often persecuted. But they were often, as well, spared because of judges and soldiers. And I gave you the one example of the guy that they were supposed to, a famous guy, we have an article on him. I won't go into the name of him right now, but he was called to be tried by Caesar, not Paul, it was after Paul. And soldiers were entrusted with taking him to Rome. And they could have put him on a ship and just taken him to Rome, but they didn't. They walked to Rome and they took the long way to go. And every place they stopped was a Christian community, because those soldiers were probably 100% Christians. And that's why they volunteered for the job of taking this Christian bishop to Rome. And so he was an old guy by the time he got there. He knew he was going to be, because of the corruption in the... We don't have the corruption that Rome eventually had, but we're not far from it. It's out there. But it's a corruption of the spirit. And you have certain people in place and in government. And just like there were certain, you know, I have this on our police page where I talk about Rome, Roman police. You know, Augustus Caesar, Tiberius Caesar, followed by Caligula, who probably... Tiberius expanded the size of the Praetorian Guard, just huge expansion to the Praetorian Guard. And he passed laws including you could be arrested for suspicion. You didn't have to actually commit a crime. And I always thought that was interesting when the Patriot Act was passed. That was one of the provisions, that you could actually be arrested for suspicion. It's just history repeating itself. But yet Tiberius sent his son-in-law to Israel to be the chief financial officer of Israel. His son-in-law was Pontius Pilate. If you're, you know, and that's considered a governor, the chief financial officer, you're overlooking the economic interests of Roman corporations operating in Judea. That's why you're there, to protect them and to keep order so that they can function. Normally, it's illegal for his wife to come with him. It was in Roman law. If you've looked up the law, I had a lot of people trying to tell me what the law is today. They haven't even looked it up. They don't go and actually read what the law is. And I get it. It's a lot of reading. But I can tell you what the law was at the time that Pontius Pilate was going to go to Judea. Well, he couldn't bring his wife. But the Senate met and changed the law just for her so that she could go with Pontius Pilate. She happened to be the granddaughter of Tiberius. So she's royalty. And she also became infatuated with the teachings of Jesus Christ and was probably one of the financial supporters of Christ. And according to Greek Orthodox, Pontius Pilate became a Christian, she became a Christian, and they both started churches in early Christianity, operated together, because he was exiled because of the fact that he allowed Jesus to be executed. But yet God arranged Pontius Pilate to be there. He arranged the wife of Pontius Pilate to be there and to speak to her husband. Pontius Pilate was an exception. He was a Gaul, by the way. He was from Gaul, from that place where Julius Caesar had murdered millions. But anyway, so he was there for God's purposes. There were probably zealots that wanted to execute Pontius Pilate. They weren't high on their list just because they knew the Romans would come and kill a million Jews if they did. But they would have liked to see him die because they thought he was corrupt from their view of morality. But a lot of their view of morality was false, because it was a part of the apostasy of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. But God arranged that Pontius Pilate be there. Who am I to oppose Pontius Pilate? God arranged it at that particular time. Now, I can't verify this, but I've seen documents that would lead me to believe that this is true. I mean, ancient documents. Tiberius was extremely ill. God may have arranged that too. He retired from his position as emperor. He left Rome. Didn't sit on the seat in Rome. He went to an island. And from that island, there is reference to the fact that he made Pontius Pilate the procurator of Rome. Now, people will debate this because people say, no, he was only the procurator of Judea. But I've seen ancient documents that say he was the procurator of Rome. That means if he signed a document, an official document, it was going to be a document that extends from the Roman Empire to the Holy Roman Empire, because he would be signing it as the emperor. Signing, not the auto pen, but actually a man who he was given the power of auto penning for Tiberius for a very short window. I don't know what that window is because the original reference doesn't say the time period, but it was right about the time of Jesus' trial. And he found, somebody just talking about this, when he washed his hands of the case, he was saying, I ain't got no jurisdiction. I have no police powers over Jesus Christ. So he's separate. Just like the Pharaoh had no police powers over Moses. Moses was the rightful Moses, it was the rightful Pharaoh of Egypt, but he didn't want the stuff like Abraham. I just want the people. But of course, he ended up with the people and a lot of the stuff. Well, that's what happened with Abraham. He didn't want any of this stuff, which suggests that he wasn't giving the people back. The people could go back, and obviously many of them did go back. But I'll lay you odds that many of the people that were worthy of staying with Abraham chose to stay with Abraham. He didn't have to give them back. And if they didn't stay with Abraham, maybe they stayed with some of those other tribes that had built these same types of altars that they had control over. But anyway, you have to understand the altars. If people don't understand that, that's really key. But So Pontius Pilate signs a document, writes it in three languages on ebony wood, which makes it black print on white background, because the ebony wood was covered in plaster, that says, Jesus Christ is King, Jesus Christ is King, Jesus Christ is King. And eventually, it's going to come up that somebody's going to say, okay, you don't want to be a part of our system anymore. You don't have to be, but you have to waive all your rights to the benefits. They haven't said that yet. If you're in the system, you're assured you're for debt. You can't just get rid of that. But that will come up. I'm just telling you, I'm not a prophet, although a lot of things I say comes true. Not professing to be a prophet. But if history repeats itself, I'm a historian. That's going to happen again. But you're not ready. You're not ready to be free, because you're not putting together a system of social welfare that creates the bonds of a free society. Moses did that when the plagues came. And the people were, they weren't perfectly ready, but they were more than they were ready before to be free. You're not ready to be free. So what you, then you can say, okay, now then you can say, I'm a Christian and you ain't got no jurisdiction. You can't say that now. A lot of people want to say Jesus is our king, but they're not doing what the king said. So the evidence is that Jesus is not really their king. They're saying, Lord, Lord, but they're not doing the will of the Father. And we've shown that in all the other programs that we've repeated over and over again, that if you don't have a system of social welfare that operates by faith, hope, and charity, you're not following Christ. Now, we don't really have that either. We just have a voice of one crying in the wilderness and a couple other people that are trying to confirm the teachings of Jesus, but I don't see the masses coming in and forming that network that the early Christians did, thousands one day, thousands more the next day, families coming together, depending upon each other for their social welfare, not eating at the table of rulers. That doesn't mean to throw their number away. They'll take it away. If you start doing that, they'll be more inclined to cut you off. And eventually they're going to have the fiscal necessity to do that. And it will be in this country and it'll be in parts of Europe, etc. But this country is a big part of what the whole world is going to go. But the elephant in the room is the fact that we're not doing what Christ said. And so therefore we have gone under the police powers of Tiberius Caesar, which he eventually died, like I say. It is believed by some. They write books about it. Can't prove it. I mean, yeah. But that Caligula, who was known as Little Boots, because he was fond of sleeping with the soldiers, had one of the Praetorian guards strangle Tiberius because he wasn't dying quick enough. He was on his sickbed. And he strangled him, which would be ironic since he expanded the Praetorian Guard and gave the boy more power. But that was his power to do that. Not always wise, but it was his power to do it. Caligula eventually was killed by rebels, storming through the emperor's palace, killing everybody related to Caligula, killing his whole family, killing everybody. And they found a guy hiding behind the curtain, a crippled guy, who happened to be a descendant of a very key person, Germanicus. And they grabbed him and they took him out to the balcony and they said, Caesar is dead. You know, behold, Caesar. And they raised his hand. That was Claudius. But Claudius was instrumental in the fate of Christians. He exiled 14,000 families from Rome. And I can almost guarantee you, they said they were Jews, because almost all the Christians were still called Jews at that time. They were Christians. And that exiling of them helped to create a network that allowed thousands and thousands of other Christians to escape places like Pompeii, places like Jerusalem, and had a place to go, because those 14,000 went out and had to live in tents all over the Roman Empire, and they created a network whereby when others had to flee the cities and flee destruction, they had a place to go. And they kept consolidating and confirming that network that Christ commanded that you create. But you have to create it. Because if you want to be the government of the people, for the people, and by the people, you have to do that. And I would recommend in the meantime, start listening to a lot of the other stuff where we're showing you how a free government actually operates. And find out what the morality, because you can't figure out morality simply by reading a book. You have to take the scales off your eyes so that you see the truth in its wholeness. And I can't give that to you. Only the Holy Spirit can give that to you. But in order to do that, you have to do major things. Giving and forgiving are top on that list. There are, and we'll cover it in our Saturday morning studies of Leviticus, there are seven things that you don't want to do. And right now, most people are doing them. And if you want to know where you can find them listed, it'd be in Proverbs 6, so that you can use that as your assignment. One of the things, as soon as you start depending upon a police force, hue and cry in society starts to diminish. And we've seen that over and over again. And so people don't know how to be the hue and cry. We got a lot of people going out obstructing police officers in the performance of a legal duty that they have. Now, we just had, over the last not too many years, we had about 20 to 30 million people come into this country, many of them unvetted, whatever that means. I've gone through the vetting process, or been firsthand observing the vetting process of United States Custom. It's not very good. But there is an actual vetting process to see if you're bringing in an out-and-out criminal. And we know that Venezuela sent its criminals the same as Cuba did. They sent their criminals and mentally deficient people and everything into the country. But there actually was in several other countries. I think Nicaragua did it. They put out notices worldwide to bring people in to go to the United States, and they give them visas. This was in, 22, 23, 24. They were going to give them visas so they could fast track looking for asylum. See, if you're looking for asylum according to international law, the first country you come to, you have to apply for asylum in that country. You can't go from country to country and country until you can apply for asylum. If you want asylum in the United States and you come into Nicaragua, you go to the American Embassy and you apply for asylum in the United States. But they weren't doing that. They were saying, we'll give you a visa to get you through our country. You came in on a visa, so you're in Nicaragua on a visa. And now you can go to the next country and say, well, I'm in Nicaragua on a visa. So the only place, if you get caught in the other country, they can ship you back to either Nicaragua or to your home country. But it was a game they were playing. Somebody figured it out to bring in hundreds of thousands, millions of people from all over the world, China, Africa, everywhere. These aren't people that were actually fleeing for asylum. They were being, and there were people financing their trips to places like Nicaragua, and so that they could head into the United States. And the goal was to change the democratic demographics of the voter in the United States. And yeah, to put, you know, I just, I read the Cato Institute's, and I looked at their statistics and how they formed them, and realized that they were just leaving out huge amounts of stuff they're trying to say. And for years, bringing in immigrants had a positive effect on the economy. And that's true. And if you go all the way back to, what, 1994, and you start counting from there, and you pool all those numbers together, it will show the immigration over those years, over 10 years or so, or more. I guess it would be 20 years. The bigger the span, the more positive influence you will see of these people. Now, it doesn't deal with details. It's, you know, like if you... They've done studies all over the world now. If you bring Somalis into your country, you will have a net loss of, well, it's actually the largest net loss. If you bring from certain underdeveloped countries, you might have a $100,000, $200,000 net loss over the period of time that they're in your country. The Somalis have the highest net loss because they don't assimilate. They get on the welfare. These are Swedish numbers. These are French numbers. These are Dutch numbers. They all see the same thing, and they categorize all the different countries. Yeah, so you have that element completely. And then are they really refugees? You know, looking for asylum. Well, like Ilhan Omar, her father was wanted for criminal activities in their country. He was to be arrested for killing people and having people put to death and robbing the government. So that was his asylum. It's like the Garcia fella. On his application for asylum, he said it wasn't that the government was going to kill him if he went back to, although they were going to imprison him. It was because of rival gangs were going to kill him. So they wanted to be in the United States. There were millions of people that came here to expand criminal activity from Chinese cartels to cartels in Asia and Africa. And they wanted to get their guys in. The same thing went on in Canada, and now they're suffering for it. But ultimately, the goal was to create chaos and to change the demographics of the voters, because they knew the days of voting the way they had been doing for the last 20 years was up. There's just a vast sea of corruption in the government. If you think you're going to elect anybody to get rid of it all, you are sadly mistaken. There's nobody's going to get rid of it all. The only one who can drive out the demons is the light. And if somebody's running for a political office, they probably are, they think that if you give me the power, I can fix this. Saul thought that. But he was corrupted by that power. And this is the thing, since we're talking about police. A policeman has more power to arrest than a citizen does. Why? Because many citizens have put their power to arrest into the police. They put it into the governor, and the governor gave it to the state police. They put it into the mayor, and the mayor put it into the city police. So they have more power to arrest. That's more power. What does power do? Power corrupts. A little power corrupts, a lot of power corrupts. It would be almost impossible for anybody to become somebody as powerful as the President of the United States and not be corrupted. But who's the culprit? The president or the people who gave him the power, knowing that power corrupts? Who sinned first, Saul or the people? The people rejected God and did. You read the speech in 1 Samuel. He's going to take and take and take and take and take your sons and the best of your fields, and you're going to cry out in that day, and I'm not going to hear you. And this is the argument that Samuel is giving them, that you don't really want to have a king. But their response to that argument was, give us a king anyway. That's the American people. They not only want a king, they think they can, of their own intellect, choose the right king. I can tell you that chances are God's hand is in whoever is your king today. But just as Tiberius was used by God to put Pontius Pilate to be used by God in place, Caligula came along and did all kinds of things. Nero started corrupting the Roman coin. He didn't start, actually. Mark Antony and Cleopatra, they demonetized the coin by 10%, 10% less silver. Nero reduced it by almost 40% less silver. But by Diocletian, there was no more silver in the Roman silver coin, and you have no silver in your coin either. And even if you have some gold and silver and you're in the United States as a U.S. citizen, they can take that from you still because you only have legal title to it. I can explain all that. Don't want to go into it. It gets off the topic. But the fact is the problem is the people. They are not taking their responsibilities back. And Christ showed us a way to do that. And we'll get into our Leviticus study and we'll show you why there was a so-called priest class. It wasn't what you think today, because you're listening to the Masoretic text and the Talmud and these other... So there were temple police also in Israel, and we could talk about that sometimes. But they didn't have the kind of that was the what they call the shatrim, the shoftim, which is probably a pay in it. And of course, all these have meanings, but they were considered police. Now, by the time you got Jesus on the scene, the temple guards came out and arrested Jesus. Well, that's police powers. Well, the original Shafim and Shatrim didn't have that kind of police powers. But originally, the Sanhedrin didn't have legislative powers. But by the time we get Jesus on the scene, that for over 100 years before, the Sanhedrin was legislating. And of course, it became more, with that power of legislation, it became more and more corrupt, no different than any other legislation anywhere in the world, Congress or Senate. They will become corrupt when you give them the power to make law for you. They can only do that if you invest in them your potestas and your imperium. There's two ways to invest that. One is by consent, which would include taking the benefits, eating at their table, which is why Proverbs tells you, Psalms tells you, don't eat at their tables, why Paul tells you, don't eat at their tables, and that their tables is a snare and a trap. So that's giving consent when you eat at their tables. If you don't want to eat at their tables, gather together and set your own tables through faith, hope, and charity. But if you give them the power to set those tables, you're giving them your power to do it. And you're neglecting your responsibilities. And so you're going to end up with a legislature making laws for you. You're going to end up with a king, a prime minister, a president going to be making laws for you because you created a vacuum. You have no daily ministration. You're not rightly dividing the bread from house to house. And so you're not even taking care of your parents in most cases. A lot of you don't even take care of your kids. They're not home taught. You send them away to Caesar to be taught. And you think you're a Christian. It doesn't work that way. Now, I will admit that some people's eyes are darkened and their kids are sent to public school and they don't see the truth. But the truth is still the truth. But God can turn what, their sloth into good. at any time, the same as he could send a man to Judea to write an official Roman document that says Jesus Christ is king. Jesus Christ is king, says it three times. And so that you can eventually actually devote your loyalty to Christ and you will have your police powers restored to you. But probably when that happens, you won't have to fight the Pharaoh. You might be ready to fight the Pharaoh, but you won't have to. Because if you fight the Pharaoh, you'll think that you, as a rebel, you saved the day. And that's one of those six things that you do not want, or seven things. It says six, even seven, that you don't want to do is take pride. And you're figuring it out. You know what's wrong, and you're going to solve it with your own power. You're not. You're going to have to let God do his part, and you're going to be given little tasks, and you do those little tasks until he gives you a bigger task. And with that, until we meet again, God bless. Join the network at Preparing You. And see us at hisholychurch.org or keysofthekingdom.info. And follow us on most podcast deals under Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory. Till then, peace on your house and may God be with you. God bless everybody. For more information, go to hisholychurch.org or preparingyou.com. Join the network. Listen to the audios at most podcast providers under Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory. Thanks, everyone, and God bless. Make sure you follow us at His Holy Church on X.